open network. Now, if we actually had a public service like a post office system, it wouldn't be a debate. You'd have to, because there'd be no incentive to censor off dissident voices. Everyone would have access, no questions asked. It's a huge fight, and it's a difficult fight because there's so much money on the other side.
What is the fate of the content providers in this world where basically the people who control the pipes and the search engines and the aggregators have the main economic power? What happens to the journalists, the musicians, the artists, and those who produce the actual content that people want to access over these systems?
Sheer unmitigated disaster. And then we all know this. Newsrooms now look like plagues. And, the Internet's not solely responsible for the collapse of journalism. I think that media consolidation has led to a shrinking of newsrooms relatively over the last 25 years. It's not a new thing. But what the Internet has done is it greatly accelerated it and made it permanent. Right now, we're faced the dark situation that there's really no way to make commercial interests can make money doing journalism in any significant level. They might be able to do it for elites, business community, in the largest markets. But the notion of having a broad, popular commercial journalism, as we understood for the last 100 years, is sort of natural. That's no longer in existence.
Robert McChesney speaking in Denver at a Media and Democracy Conference in 2013. A beloved professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He appeared on Democracy Now! Many times. You can go to democracynow.org for all interviews. He's died at the age of 72. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Mike Burke.
This is Logan,
Colin,
and Jeremiah,
and we are Amnesia, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you'll hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to check out our specials, go to kboo.fm/AT.
Stay tuned for Seeking Peace on Earth, a Peace Talks radio special. Some compelling moments from our series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution.
King understood that if the goal is worth it, if you found something worth dying for, then you don't have that fear of death.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Cesar and myself, we did a lot of research. If we turn to violence, we'll use it against each other. You know, so we have to stay away from violence.
But I was 57 and going through this, so it was really hard to all of a sudden have everything taken away.
Yeah, right.
I still feel sad about that.
He takes his gun and everything and put it all on the counter beside me.
We're not going to hate you, baby. It's a good thing that you're giving up, so we're not going to hate you.
That's all ahead on Seeking Peace on Earth, a Peace Talks radio special. This is Seeking Peace on Earth, a Peace Talks radio special. Ahead, some compelling and timeless moments drawn from just one of our many seasons of programs in the Peace Talks radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls with Carol Boss and Suzanne Kreider. And ahead, you'll hear part of our conversation with the Atlanta school clerk, who, by showing compassion and empathy, helped foil a potential school shooter's plan to wreak havoc on an elementary school. Also, some talk with historians who tell us about several peacemaking chapters in the stories of Teddy, Franklin, and Eleanor Roosevelt. And we'll hear from the woman who walked side by side with Cesar Chavez in the farm workers' movement, recalling his deep commitment to nonviolence. Also on the show, finding peace with disability, raising boys to steer them away from violence and crime, and conscientious objectors in the volunteer military. But first, some clips from an episode in which we invited a couple of top scholars of the life of Martin Luther King Jr. to pick three of his many inspirational speeches to look at more deeply. In a moment, Dr. Claiborne Carson, but first, the late Vincent Harding, who was a colleague and occasional speechwriter for the civil rights icon. He chose Dr. King's speech capping off the Selma to Montgomery March, considered pivotal in the movement in March of 1965. I asked Dr. Harding to talk about King's reframing of the idea of what should be considered, quote, normal in Deep South communities in the 1960s.
I know that is a cry today in Alabama. We see it in numerous editorials. When will Martin Luther King, SCLC, SNCC, and all of these civil rights agitators and all of the white clergymen and labor leaders and students and others get out of our community and let Alabama return to normalcy?
He is saying what you have experienced in the past must not be allowed to be your judgment of what is good and what is necessary and what is needed for your life. You must now begin to envision a new society, as he put it, a new normalcy, which brings us together.
Well, we know that it was normalcy in marriage that led to the brutal murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson. It was normalcy in Birmingham that led to the murder on Sunday morning of four beautiful, unoffending, innocent girls. It is normalcy all over Alabama that prevents the Negro from becoming a registered voter. No, we will not allow Alabama to return to normalcy.
In a sense, he was saying the same thing to the country. Do not accept segregation, either by law or by practice, as an acceptable way of life.
Just as he was boldly asking his audience to confront their fears, it seems that he tackles maybe the next most common objection in social movements, that change takes too long. How long? Not long, he says again and again toward the end of this speech.
Speaking about the various tasks that had to be done, Martin knew that those things could not be done overnight, could not be done, quote, now. What he knew was they had to begin now. People had to commit themselves to do the work now, but he did not want people to feel that never was the answer either. So he kept calling, not long.
How long? How long? How long? Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. How long? Not long. Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Glory, hallelujah. Glory, hallelujah. Glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on.
This episode also included conversation with Dr. Vincent Harding about the speech he helped write for Dr. King that was delivered April 4, 1967, exactly a year before King's assassination. It's known as his Vietnam speech, when he explicitly came out against the U.S. involvement in the war in Southeast Asia.
King was essentially asking people to take their religion seriously. He was saying, there must be another way to deal with our enemies.
He does take the speech to 5 points to follow to end the war, but then he broadens the scope. One of the more powerful lines is,
We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West, the Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world. If we will but make the right choice, we will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
MLK scholar Dr. Claiborne Carson was a guest on this episode, too, choosing to talk about Dr. King's last speech, given April 3rd, the night before he died in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968.
One thing he does in all of them is he takes the immediate issue and puts it in a broader context. The audience in front of him are there because they're involved in a labor strike. They're trying to get more dollars per hour for their work and have better working conditions. But he tries to tell them that it's not about getting 20 cents more an hour for your work or 10 cents more an hour. That's not what is really driving this. It's you're part of a freedom movement that was going on before you were born, and it will affect your children and grandchildren. And he was saying that this is a freedom movement that is comparable to the great freedom movements throughout history.
Whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today.
King understands that it's a privilege to be there as these victories are occurring, to be part of that struggle. Many wonderful people in the history of the world, you know, Gandhi never really got the opportunity to live in a free India. Many people don't survive the struggle. But King understood that if the goal is worth it, if you found something worth dying for, then you don't have that fear of death. And I think that's what he wanted to convey to his audience, that he had seen some momentous changes in the world and that had made his life worth living.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Less than 24 hours later, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, shot while standing on his hotel balcony in Memphis. To hear the complete hour-long program on these three speeches, visit peacetalksradio.com and look for the January 2014 episode. I'm Paul Ingalls, and you're listening to Seeking Peace on Earth, a Peace Talks radio special featuring compelling excerpts from just one season of our shows on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. And now an excerpt from a conversational profile we presented on the show of Cesar Chavez, who, along with Dolores Huerta, founded the United Farm Workers Union in the early 1960s, and who made the pursuit of fair labor practices, civil rights, and nonviolence his life's work before his death in 1993. Our Carol Boss talked with Chavez biographer Jose Antonio Orozco, and here, Chavez's UFW colleague and friend, Dolores Huerta.
Could you Take us through, let's say, an argument to even one person who you were trying to convince not to buy grapes, someone who really couldn't understand. What would you say to them?
Well, for the most part, people were very sympathetic, and the message was simple. You know, we have farm workers in California are on strike. Farm workers don't have toilets in the fields. They don't have drinking water. They don't have any protections from pesticides. And we need your help. And when you have farm workers themselves that are telling the story, and people can see in their faces and see, you know, hear directly from them, it was a very, very powerful message.
In March 1966, that walk, 300-mile walk from Delano to Sacramento, California's capital, which was really a way of dramatizing this what was already a six-month-old grape strike. And I know that one goal was to stress nonviolence and make more visible the nonviolent tactics. Why was that an important goal of the march?
Well, because the history, when you look at the history of labor organizing in the fields of California, it had always been one of violence. If you read John Steinbeck's novels, you know, The Grapes of Wrath, the other novels that he wrote about the early strikes that they had in California, there was violence and people were killed. And before we started the union, Cesar and myself, we did a lot of research, and we didn't want that to happen again. We didn't want the people to turn to violence, either on the part of the farm workers or on the part of the growers. Of course, eventually, you know, we did have people that were killed. We have five martyrs that were killed in the farm workers movement. But and Cesar, one of the things that he always stressed is that if we turn to violence, we'll use it against each other. You know, so we have to stay away from violence. And he actually made everybody take a standing vow that we would not resort to violence. And that's why when we did that march, it was a pilgrimage. The other thing was the pilgrimage did not go through the big cities. It went through all of the farm worker towns. When the pilgrimage started, as they left Delano, California, there were probably, I would say, 70 to 90 farm workers that started. By the time that the farm workers and Caesar arrived in Sacramento, there were 10,000 people there.
We're fighting for recognition, which is the real guts of it. It doesn't matter now how much money they're offered. They wouldn't go back because what they want is a union before they go back.
This is Peace Talks Radio, and we're talking to Jose Antonio Orozco, author of Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence. So according to Chava, La Causa, as the farm workers' struggle was called, it attempted to improve the working conditions, of course, of farm workers, but he also saw it as developing a larger mission over time.
I think that Cesar Chavez saw at a certain part that the reason that the farm workers were struggling was an unequal power balance between the growers and the farm workers. And he started to see that it was about various kinds of power inequalities in American society in general. And he started to see, he makes this connection between the violence that he saw when the growers would call the police out or they would hire security to protect the fields and that they would push the farm workers around. He saw connections between that kind of violence that was going on and violence and in the streets and in the riots during the 1960s. And then also the idea of the United States being involved in Vietnam. And so he started to see that there were connections of structural violence around the world and started to put all of this together that, you know, the reason that the farm workers were struggling was that because agriculture was becoming corporatized and that there were people who were willing to use violence to protect those corporate interests against the interests of the farm workers.
When people think about dedication to nonviolence, most people think of Gandhi, King, maybe the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
What does Cesar Chavez bring that is unique?
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is that typically when you talk about nonviolence, you have this kind of litany of heroes that are engaged in nonviolence. So people will say, oh, yeah, Tolstoy, Thoreau, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and sometimes they'll mention Chavez or Dolores Huerta. But I think that Chavez offers and his practice and the way he talked about nonviolence was very, very different from the way in which, for instance, Gandhi and Martin Luther King thought about the effectiveness of nonviolence. And he didn't believe, of course, in violence, but he did believe that sometimes in order to achieve justice, you have to create tension in a community. You have to create a kind of disruption so that the status quo, which is of injustice, cannot continue. And this is, of course, something that Martin Luther King talked about in his letter from a Birmingham jail, of creative tension necessary to disrupt the status quo. But Chavez was willing to engage in politics that I think Gandhi would not have thought appropriate for a person of nonviolence.
The boycott, the strike has been a costly thing not only to us, but also to the employers. But I think that because, even though however unfortunate the experience might have been and the struggle on both sides, that because of that experience, we have created the foundation to what I think is going to be a very good working relationship with the grower community in Delano.
More from our Cesar Chavez episode in the February 2014 program at peacetalksradio.com. Next on today's program,
I tried to talk out loud to myself and I sounded funny. So I called a friend of mine and I said, "This is Suzanne Kreider." And she said, "I don't know what you just said. Go to an emergency room." Well, that freaked me out. And so I stood up and I could not walk. And I just said, "Oh no, this cannot be happening. No, I cannot be having a stroke."
How do people make peace with a sudden disability, internally and in reintegrating with the world at large? Our own Suzanne Kreider tells her own tale when we return after this break. You're listening to Seeking Peace on Earth, a Peace Talks radio special, featuring some compelling and timeless moments drawn from just one of our many seasons of programs in the Peace Talks radio series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. In May of 2012, our Peace Talks radio co-founder, Suzanne Kreider, experienced what's known as an AVM, an arterial venal malformation. This caused some bleeding in her brain that left her speech and movement compromised. After months of recovery, she was ready to get back on the air and tell us about it, and do some interviews for a program we called Making Peace with Disability, during which we explored the inner conflict from disability and the challenge of integrating with the rest of society.
And I went through this phase of really being embarrassed to be out in the world because I was falling over. I had a walker. I looked 80 years old. Nothing against people who were older, but I was 57 and going through this, and I'm super fit. So it was really hard to all of a sudden have everything taken away.
Yeah, right.
I still feel sad about that.
Yeah. So you were describing to me having to go through a mourning period.
Yes. Well, I had a meditation teacher who is also a therapist say to me, "Suzanne, of course you are upset. You lost the most important person in your life." So when Nikki said that, I realized, oh, I should be grieving. This is like a mourning because I lost the ability to drive. I don't see well. I'd lost the ability to hike, camp, backpack, make choices about everything I do. So I'm really a different person, and I really lost this person who was so important to me. Suzanne Kreider, she was so healthy and so fit and so great. I loved her. She's gone. She will never be back. Mm-hmm. So now I'm learning how to mourn her loss, which I don't know. A friend of mine recently said, he's a therapist too. I said, how long will I be mourning this loss? And he said, I don't know, maybe your whole life.
Later in our show, Suzanne talked with Dr. Susan Stutzner, herself wheelchair-bound from an injury and a researcher on disability issues. Suzanne also talked with some physically challenged people at a disability issues conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I'm so curious how people learn about how to treat disabled people. So is there anything you recommend that we could teach parents or educators on how to interact with people with disabilities?
Within the public school system, that certainly a lot of learning could happen, you know, within the classroom, teachers, administrators, as they got more inclusive and more comfortable with students with disabilities or with introducing some of their students to professionals with disabilities so that they learn to see this as a more normalized experience, not just as something that happens by chance. I think also as parents, you know, certainly parents can learn to treat people with disabilities with respect because children will model after their parents. So that is certainly one way to approach this. You know, another is, you know, just changing the whole societal framework of how we view diversity. So my question is, why aren't we acting in ways that respect diversity? We're just not all going to look the same, act the same, be the same. And it's the ways in which we're different, you know, that make this a great place to live.
Dustin Berg from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm a T7 paraplegic. I was in a motorcycle wreck in 2003, so I use a wheelchair now. You know, everybody, whether they're able-bodied or disabled-bodied, they can focus on a list of things they can do, and that can go on forever. Or they can focus on a list of things they can't do, and that list can go on forever. And it's just, which list are you going to focus on? And then, you know, for me, that was, you know, very big in my accepting my situation. And then, trying to abandon a lot of my fears about my situation and just go on with my life and try and pursue the opportunities that are available. And I realized that, you know, it's definitely not the end of my life, and I have still very live a very full and fulfilling life.
In a Rolling Stone article, Michael J. Fox just said he has Parkinson's, and this is what he said at the end of the article. If I walked into a room with God or Buddha or Bill Gates or Sergey Brin or whoever could figure out a way to fix it for me, I don't think I'd do it. Because I wouldn't have gone through what I've gone through, and I wouldn't have had the experience I've had. What do you think about that? And would you change this? If someone could change it?
I mean, that is a really tough question. I understand what he's saying, that you definitely grow as a person. You add tons of character, and you grow mentally in ways that you couldn't have grown without dealing with the experiences you've dealt with. I wish I could go back and walk, but then keep all the experiences and even the hard ones, because they've made me a better person. Man, that's a tough one, you know. I want them both.
More on Making Peace with Disability at peacetalksradio.com in our May 2014 episode. After documentary producer Ken Burns released his PBS series on the Roosevelts in 2014, we decided to zoom in closer on some of the peacemaking chapters of Teddy, Franklin, and Eleanor Roosevelt, including a talk with Charles Doliak, attorney and expert on the Portsmouth Peace Treaty, which ended the brutal Russo-Japanese War in 1905 and earned Teddy Roosevelt one of the earliest Nobel Peace Prizes.
You know, Roosevelt did three things. First of all, he got the parties to come here. That's a big deal, just getting them to the table. Second thing he did is he said, if you're going to negotiate and you reach an issue that you do not agree to, I encourage you to just skip over it and go to the next issue. And that's the way they negotiated. And what happened was they had a number of issues that they had to decide in terms of control of Korea and Manchuria. And they agreed on all of those issues, which are like, you know, 9 or 10 of the 12 issues involved. So by the time they went back to the two that they had not agreed on, they had an awful lot of good stuff on the table that they really didn't want to leave and go back to war over. So he created that methodology. And third, he was involved, he critically was involved in back-channel diplomacy with both the Russians and the Japanese. He had a direct line with the Japanese, and he had sent, realizing what the Russians were and how they operated, he had his best friend, a guy from Harvard who was a diplomat, one of the best diplomats the United States had, sent to Moscow, to St. Petersburg, to be the one that talked to the Tsar, and he went and talked to the Tsar at a critical stage and got the Tsar to agree to give up some territory that he probably would not have agreed to, which was a critical part of the compromise. And he deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for what he did. He really did. But surrounding all of this, keeping them at the table, was this local groups that were trying to foster a good atmosphere for peace.
Roosevelt back then and Doliak and other historians since now give the townsfolk of Portsmouth, New Hampshire a lot of credit for keeping the Russian and Japanese negotiators in talks when things were getting a little shaky. Now some perspective on the peace and justice philosophies of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt a little later down the historical timeline from author, professor, and Roosevelt scholar Alida Black from the George Washington University.